Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Angad Daryani. Angad is the founder of Praan.io, spelled Praan.io, a deep tech startup bringing clean air to corporate spaces and homes. Praan's products, Hive and Mach, spelled M-A-C-H, have delighted its customers. Praan is the epitome of the Make in India mission, sourcing close to 95% of its parts in India, completely manufactured and assembled in India. Angad is an entrepreneur to watch out for. In this episode, I sit down with Angad to talk about his long-term mission for a cleaner world with Praan, his struggles building such an innovative hardware company ground up, and his philosophy around hiring and retaining top talent. Please do like, share, and subscribe this podcast, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like Spotify, Apple, etc. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in. Hello, Angad. Welcome to the podcast.
Of course, no. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I know this conversation is all going to be about Praan and the wonderful company that you have built. But before we get started, I hear that you started a company at 12 and 14, two different companies, that is. One was called SharkKids and the other called SharkBot Systems. What is it with sharks and founding from such an early age?
Sure. So I actually grew up watching a lot of National Geographic and Discovery Channel. And as it would happen, you know, right from kindergarten, you know, my sessions would be either in the morning or in the afternoon. So I would watch TV after coming back or before going to school. And in that afternoon slot on Discovery Channel would usually be these aquatic animals and sharks. So I would almost watch it every day, and I built a fascination towards the creature, like this so aerodynamic and cool and predator of the sea and so on. So that stuck with me for a while. With respect to the two companies, when I was very young, when I was building these things and fascinated by science, internet was still new, but in the US, students would have access to Lego, or they'd be able to go to Home Depot or other stores and buy these small DIY kits, which was not the case in India. The only option we had as a kid was mechanics, and hobby ideas used to have these wooden craft sculptures you can build. But I would follow along with these, and as while I had the opportunity to, you know, with help from parents, talking to their friends or etc., you know, get me parts from here and there to build small prototypes. I was just wondering, what if every child in India could learn these science concepts on their own, and the sheer amount of makers that we could build out of India? Because at young age, if students are exposed to science hands-on, it's, you know, irreversible. They'd be ultra passionate about building things. So we said, how do we make kits that are accessible, that teach real-world skills? This is before pre-edtech boom, right? That will actually add value to the world. And that was the thought process behind SharkKids. SharkBot 3D Systems also is like a subset of what was happening there. So as I was building and following these, the maker movement in the US, there's nothing like it in India. And at the time, the 3D printer was new in the US, and I wanted one but couldn't get one. And it was too expensive for a 10, 12-year-old child to spend, you know, at the time, 2.5 lakh rupees to buy a maker bot. So basically salvaged parts, found some people who were selling some parts similar to what could go in the 3D printer, and built one. And even then, it, you know, ended up costing me about $400, and MakerBot was being sold for around, you know, $3,000 or $4,000, if I'm not wrong. So said, you know, no one can afford this at that time in India. So how do we build something that's accessible? Because if an engineer has access to a 3D printer, his sheer speed of building products is exponentially higher. So again, it was impact perspective, saying the parts are not that expensive. Why are they overcharging? Why is it so expensive? And so, right, built it from scratch. It was pretty junky, but the fact that we could still do it, went around college just teaching engineering students how to build it, even led to a company called Fractal Works. One of the people I sold a kit to started a 3D printing company. And I think they're still existent and have served some defense companies today.
That is, I mean, that makes for a remarkable story to pitch for your SAT essays and all of that. And eventually you found your way to Georgia Tech. Was electrical engineering what you wanted to do always because, you know, of your background with making these companies, right? So how was the Georgia Tech experience and how was the major?
So actually, I when I applied to college, I got rejected from almost every college I applied to. And I used to work with the MIT Media Lab for 2.5 years, and I still got rejected when I applied to MIT. And the reason was that when I dropped out of school in ninth grade and was working with the MIT Media Lab, I got fascinated with doing real world things, and the day to day like history project or whatever felt super unnecessary in terms of the hours I could allocate in a day to doing. Like on one side, getting the opportunity to work on health technology that will change lives for 100 million people next day, I'm being asked to spend the same amount of time copy-pasting information from the internet into a craft book. So because of these factors, you know, I was not super motivated in school. And as a result, as an international student applying to MIT, Harvard, Stanford, actually got rejected from all of them. So I went to UMass Amherst for my sophomore year. My grades were not bad, but they were not at the top 0.1% to get in. I went to UMass Amherst and transferred to Georgia Tech. And electrical engineering fundamentally was like, there's two general engineerings which help you build anything, and that's mechanical and electrical. Mechanical has some small elements of embedded systems and electrical, but electrical engineering has signal processing, machine learning, power electronics, radar systems. So it felt like the most general physics, widespread engineering, which would give me the fundamentals to do, you know, to build whatever I wanted in the future.
That makes a lot of sense because, you know, as I'm hearing people talk about, hey, what should I study in this day and age of AI? And the thought process across platforms and across leaders is that, you know, get your fundamentals right. If you know your math, if you know how something works, then you will always be in demand. And I think electrical and mechanical, I did mechanical for undergrad, and I think it is so diverse and it is so vast that you can easily pivot and get a lot of transferable skills. Yeah, excellent. So you go to Georgia Tech, and I believe this was on the F1 visa. And the reason why I'm stressing on visa is because of the challenges that someone faces on a visa to start a company. And when you graduated, were you thinking about whether do I go the corporate route or did you always have this startup mentality? Because you were already a serial entrepreneur by that point.
I mean, so, you know, I started what became Pran in my sophomore year of college. And, you know, I couldn't legally register a company, you know, because of visa violation challenges with F1. But at the same time, you know, if you want to start a project or a company, you have to give it a name, you have to get a logo, make a website. You know, my email signature used to have founder@Pran. And, you know, unknowingly, once I applied to the immigration office in my school, you know, international student office, and they saw it and they tried to look for my visa status. And they're like, oh, this is going to be a big problem. This kid is running a company on an F1 visa. So there's definitely under a lot of pressure from the college. Till they dug deeper and realized it's only a LinkedIn page and a logo and there's no organization and hence no violation. But basically, I was threatened to get kicked out of the United States because they thought I was violating something. No regrets. But I think just the, you know, my parents have always been incredibly supportive and, you know, they always said, do what makes you happy and what you're excited and, you know, as far as you're doing the right things. But even they were like, you know, you go to a good college, you're getting all these opportunities. Because after my freshman year, I got an internship offer from Facebook, right? And at that time, an Indian kid who goes to the US getting a Silicon Valley offer, I never applied for it. It came through my MIT network saying, you know, that literally the message was, hey, what are you up to? Why don't you take a break and come join a team at Facebook for a few months? That was no interview, nothing. There's a text message. The next day, a recruiter called me for, logistics, numbers, visa status, all of that stuff, right? So I couldn't, unfortunately couldn't take it because I was migrating schools. So my visa would temporarily not exist while that was happening. But they were just like, you've let go of this and you've been at it startups. So I was interviewing with Tesla, Rivian, Microsoft, all final rounds. Tesla had interviewed me for 8 months, right? For from first round with director of engineering at Tesla Energy System to the entire team meeting with me. They flew me down to Palo Alto a couple of times, so parents were always like, why don't you take these for some time, build your network, get some experience, then start this company. I think as fate would have it with COVID, Pran was destined to happen, or at least I was destined to work on it for some time.
You mentioned about how you started Pran, or the germination of the idea happened at Georgia Tech. And you started this whole journey with a bunch of volunteers, from what I understand. Did you have a selection process, or was it like, hey, are you passionate about something? Then come work with me. We are all going to figure it out. Because you probably did not have a very strong hiring plan at the point, and you were also probably figuring things out yourself, right?
I think that the thought process, firstly, to do this during college, and I think it would be something a lot of students think about, especially international students, is that if you go to a good college or you're in a college where you're satisfied, what's the worst that can happen if you try something and fail before you graduate? Right? You would have still learned far more real-world meaningful skills that are beneficial to any business, as opposed to what you would do at a very large company's internship, going to parties over the weekend, intern parties and so on. There was thought process of saying, I go to a top-tier school in the world, it's recognized. If I try something ultra risky and it fails, nothing happens. If it succeeds, we'll change an industry forever. And so far that seems to be the case, right? Because filterless technology is now real. And so with respect to hiring, mentally founders are always 10 stages ahead of reality, and that was still the case with me as well. So I already assumed this is a real company with a real logo, a LinkedIn page, fancy people in my network at MIT, Stanford, all these places follow it, it's legit. So because CNN had come and shot with me in Atlanta, and that video had gone viral, more and more people were intrigued. So I just tried an experiment of putting up a Google form saying, join me and work on these things. Because I knew the different skill sets we needed, even in engineering, in mechanical, you need like a CFD engineer, mechanical design, manufacturing. For embedded, you need hardware, firmware, power electronics, chemical engineers. So basically put up all these generic roles and said it's unpaid and it's volunteering. And if you get selected and you help contribute to what we patent, I'll give you recognition on the patent. And we've honored that. So I didn't have money to pay, and I legally also couldn't. But what I could do is, at the living room of an apartment or a park bench, work on these difficult problems together, build some prototypes and MVPs which bring in hands-on skills. And as a result, if it were to work out, either offer jobs or equity or patent recognition. And if it didn't work out, we all learned something beyond college, and that's it. The hiring process was super strict. Again, you apply, your resume is looked at, LinkedIn is looked at. There's a first, round and a lot of deep diving into your projects to see if you've got a good fit. First team was pretty solid, man. Like mechanical lead worked at BMW for 2 summers. Right in Germany, then embedded system guys were 2 people from Microsoft, and also some of them who didn't know anything, just because good smart kids from Georgia Tech. I knew nothing about bioengineering, but hired a few people from Emory University and Georgia Tech's biomedical engineering department to figure it out, so at least we'd be on learning trajectory. Eventually it grew to Stanford and other places, but yeah, I think kept it strict, kept it focused. Those who are passionate, just think about it, right? You already go to an intense school. You're struggling to just keep up with homework and exams. Then you take this on, and you are basically working till 2 in the morning after hours. I remember in winter season, we have worked, when it's snowing outside, in a parking lot, in public parking lot. We blew out the lights on the parking lot by mistake. But yeah, I think people who are super passionate is why we've got in here. And of course, we went back and offered them opportunities, but we're still not funded, ultra risky, so they chose not to take it.
When you say that, hey, I come from I'm sure upper middle class or middle class family, and then go into Georgia Tech. I am at Georgia Tech. If I don't try, then who else will, right? And it actually resonated with me so much because yesterday I was talking to Guy Kawasaki, who was the chief evangelist of Apple and now the chief evangelist of Canva. And he's like the biggest, I don't know, owner of the fact that it was nepotism what got him into Apple in the first place. But then he told me about how it's not the nepotism, but what you do with the nepotism that makes all the difference. So, if someone is already at a stage where taking a risk is not that much of a negative, then why not do it? And I think it must have been extremely difficult not to take that Facebook offer, but focus on something that you really, really love, right? So, that's pretty good.
I mean, you see, if I didn't go through, say, the 8 months with Tesla or Microsoft, I would have not learned the processes and the do's and don'ts that we have at Prant today. So, at least we learned to keep our standards high. When I went to Tesla, and now, in our most recent round, Elon Musk's number two and senior leaders in manufacturing invested in our company. So, what was real is that whatever culture we had built at Pran, without knowing anything about Tesla, was very similar. It was just everyone working towards a mission, really smart people taking bold risks, focusing on fundamentals in physics and manufacturing, not caring about the preset rules, but saying, what is it fundamentally that will solve this problem? Then let's figure out how to make a business around it or what product to put it in. And then figure out how to get it to scale. So it was really built from building blocks. Is this problem solvable? If so, how can we build it? And then if we built it, what product it would, translate into.
So even while hiring volunteers, you had a very, very high bar, and you did make sure that they are getting into something that they will eventually love, and their past experience was kind of an indication on what they would love to do. So you are at Georgia Tech, and I hear this from a lot of people, and I have seen this myself, my parents. The skies in the Western world look extremely different. It's so much bluer and all of that. So you are in Atlanta. What makes you think about a solution to India or the global South? Because I'm pretty sure the filtration or the air quality index is majorly a problem. Is there a personal story attached to this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still Indian, right? Born and brought up in Bombay. I grew up with asthma. I used to play football or soccer professionally. Never made it to the A team or the, state team. Would get very close, never made it because my stamina would be lower than my peers due to respiratory problems. We went through a series of treatments. I would also swim professionally to help play soccer better so that lung capacity, et cetera, improve. But there were realities that, okay, there's, because of this asthma situation, there is a limitation, right? And then also the reality that every winter season, this would get aggravated significantly because of fireworks and just the air quality getting worse every winter due to inversion. So every winter season when I was younger, my parents would have to leave the city and go to a hill station with me so that, I was comfortable. So these were all realities that I grew up with. And as I grew up, while I could move to another country with a cleaner environment, I can't expect my friends, family to displace themselves for something as general as air quality, right? It's a basic human need. People should not have to migrate because air is bad. And I think a couple of weeks ago, there was an article which said only six out of 192 countries have clean air today. Switzerland was not on that list. So a basic human right, a necessity, and one that's killing people every day is no longer abundant. So if you're building a product or company in that space, whatever form the product business model takes, you're solving a problem that 7 billion people in the world out of 8 billion need. So that was the bet.
I was watching a documentary about price rise in real estate in Vancouver. You must be thinking where this is going, but I can explain. So the story was that the artists and long-term residents from the city of Vancouver were getting priced out by investors from China, and they were all these millennial kids, sons and daughters of coal magnates in China, and they were all located in relatively interior parts of China where the air quality is not that great. And when they were interviewed, they said that, yeah, we have an extremely luxurious life in China, but we are buying properties out here in Vancouver because you cannot buy clean air with money. And that was quite reality check for a lot of people, I'm sure. Just a small anecdote of how I got to know of just the difference
But
in.
just imagine, right? These are billionaires in China who are doing it. What does we're not billionaires. What do our families do, right? Which means that they are lung like their lifespan is getting cut short by 10, 15 years for sure. And why, right? If you can spend $1,000, $5,000 to fix it, it's a dumb thing to invest in and make sure your house has clean air, office has clean air. Right, you're anyways getting out of the house, going into your car or some cab. So you have ways to deal with it, even if the government isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get on with the early stage of Pran. So you get out of the college and you have to pitch your idea to investors. What were some of the early feedbacks that you received, and did you get ghosted? Because again, this could be recent memory, but in my episode with Guy Kawasaki, we were talking about how the Canva founder pitched it to 299 investors before she got her first yes. So, what was your experience with early pitch and VCs like?
Not much different than hers. I think mine may have been, I don't know specifics about her pitches, but firstly, I'd never pitched to investors. I didn't know which fund is better than which and why. I was just Googling names, got introduced to a few funds through somebody who knew people there. I think still very early on in India's venture capital journey.
And also, this was a time when venture capital wasn't a thing. I mean, this was before the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, right? This was way before money started pouring into climate tech. So, yeah.
Yeah, and SaaS was a thing. People would invest in software companies which could multiply, or consumer companies. And Indian venture capital follows Western capital or lags by a decade, at least 7 to 10 years. And then the real venture capital in the US lags, industry leaders by another 3 to 5 years. So Indian venture capital was technically between 10 and 15 years behind Western moonshot funding capital. So I'm pitching to these people for no fault of theirs, but Indian venture capital is more private equity than venture capital. It's like a mini private equity at lower prices, right? Because they're looking for the same things, evaluating it as a revenue multiple. A company with no team, no product can't give you revenue multiple valuation. Because I think it's borderline stupid to even ask, right? So I pitched to, I think in India, first round was maybe 30, 40 funds, all said no. They made me write a bunch of long emails and never read them, right? And I also didn't know how to deal with investors, how the pitch should work, the dynamics, how does a fund work, all those things. Today it's very different. Then COVID hit, all venture capital funding froze. And then I was like, okay, shit, I don't have any money to fund this. So I was bombarding investors around the world. I think I've taken at least 1,000 meetings between 2020 and end of like sometime 2021 when we actually raised money. So I'm talking Jan 2020 to June 2021. Right. Some in these 1,000-odd meetings would also mean like there was a fund I had 30 calls with who eventually only ponied up 100K. Right. And today, 100K is like not even an email. I think my investor will be surprised if I ask for 100K. Like, what are you gonna do with like what is this number? It's too small to ask, right? But yeah, I think these are the kind of all said no. Some said maybe, some wanted me to change what I'm trying to do to make a consumer product and a branding play. Eventually not to be an R&D company, but import from China, white label and sell. Glad we stuck to what we want to do. Of course, we didn't have all this clarity earlier. I think as we build, clarity improves. But no, deep tech venture capital for moonshots did not exist. Right? So we were raising at a weird time.
Yeah, and you fondly write about some advice that you received from Ratan Tata and also how a grant from Emergent Ventures changed your life.
I mean, yeah, I think the two, I think, most iconic meetings I've had, one was Ratan Tata and second was Dr. APJ Kalam. I think Ratan Tata was more curious than, advice, because I was pitching to him as part of MIT's projects. Dr. APJ Kalam met me when I dropped out of school, again through MIT. He said, continue to build, don't go back to school, you'll lose your curiosity. That was from
I
the
am shocked
president of
that
India.
this came from Dr. Kalam because, wow.
A legendary man. I think one of my fondest meetings till date.
Yeah, it is crazy because I remember when I was in sixth grade, I remember my dad printing me out this speech of his. He was an ISRO scientist back then. And he was like, "Hey, this is a fantastic speech. Maybe you should go give it to your class teacher." And they were like, "Okay, yeah, whatever." And then a few months later, he became the president. And they were like, "Hey, could you give me that speech?" So he was remarkable as a scientist. And I think when he passed away, unfortunately, there were so many people who were recollecting their memories with him, and I don't think anyone has received so much pan India love than him. So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
When I met him, I was actually really surprised because in media he looks taller than he is, and I'm not a very tall guy. I'm only 5'6", and he was like even shorter than me. And I was like, this guy is a president of our country, but he's building missiles and rockets, which are sizes like larger than the building we're standing in. It just in incredible meeting both Mr. Tata and Dr. Kiran.
What was your meeting with Mr. Tata like? You said he was curious.
Yeah, so basically, I can't share numeric details because it's, so MIT was pitching Tata Group, Tata's center at MIT, to fund what they were calling the MIT India Initiative. And they did fund it. But three people were asked to pitch as part of it, along with, Dr. Ramesh Raskar and John Werner. And that was two other engineers and me. I was the youngest person in that room. Possibly also the card, right? That, hey, this is future India, young India, you need to support it. And so he heard me very intently. He asked me questions about the product, and he's like, how do I scale this to, X million blind people? I was working on a project for the visually impaired. He was really like intently listening as though somebody was going to buy the product and scale it. Like he was there because he wanted the impact, and of course he funded it. But all the questions were really around how do you scale this, and then how soon can we scale this, and there is, I think he told the professor, Dr. Ramesh Raskar, after he funded them, he said, this is the best, whatever X million dollars I've spent in my life, right? They're finding it on these projects. So I think that validates it. And I remember two things specifically. One is throughout the meeting, this was at the Taj in Bombay. His staff kept bringing him bowls of dates, and I was like, I have never seen somebody eat these many dates throughout a meeting. So I was, I think, very intriguing. I was like, this guy, eats a lot of iron. The second thing was when he visited our lab, India lab, where we're working on these projects with MIT. He visited it once, he saw it, and he drove off. And then he was so curious, he made the driver turn around, came back, spent another 2 hours with us after. Right. So these were, I think, in the fact that he deeply cared, money didn't matter. He's like, this stuff is going to change the world, and if not Tata, who else?
And to your point about Dr. Kalam telling you not to go to school, I think it is so similar to what happened with Elon. So he enrolled for a PhD degree in Stanford, and this was a time when internet was sort of taking off. And he was like, "Do I spend 5 years in Stanford and see internet make a boom right in front of my eyes, or do I go play in that playground?" That's fantastic. It's kind of eerily similar, Tesla, Elon, and your journey, even though there is so much to
Elon
spell out.
definitely a hero for all of us. The things he's done has changed the world. And if people like us can even become a fraction of what he's built, I think the world will be a better place. Basically need a few hundred Elons in the world. I think things will change.
Awesome. So you get some funding, you also get some funding from friends and family, and you start building Pran. Now, making a prototype is easy. Manufacturing at scale is difficult, and getting your first customers is just as difficult. So how did you, let's say, go through that process of maybe first build a prototype, then get customers, or maybe run some demos? What were those initial steps like?
So of course the company has evolved over time, and what we do has gotten more and more focused. We started purely by building outdoor air purifiers, not knowing a thing about how this will actually scale. The focus was can filterless technology be realized? Because if it was, then you would have allowed air purifiers to have no recurring cost of ownership, right? First was, can we actually build something that's capturing something from the air and collecting it as proof case? Then becomes area of influence, then how you can, what kind of areas can this be deployed, and so on and so forth. So first was when no VC was able to fund us. This is like, I think, pre-VC pitches also. Like I was trying to get a grant of 1 crore, which is about like $120,000 today. And I went to all these CSR companies. I wrote to a lot of billionaires in India, right? Think, hey, please give me 1 crore. It's an insignificant amount of money, right? Today, raising 1 crore is, like I said, if I text somebody on WhatsApp, I need 1 crore on these terms. The money will come before the document, right? But the sort of at the time, nobody's willing to fund us. So my dad's best friend is a consultant to some large corporates, and he said, hey, why don't all of us, 5-10 of us, just put a small sum of money together, we'll write it as an unsecured loan in your name. The thought process was just to make me accountable. I was a young kid, and didn't have too much money, so first time having $15,000 is a lot of money for a freshman sophomore year engineer. So they basically wired 1 lakh rupees, which is like $1,200, $1,300 to my bank account. So in 2 days, I had, the 10 lakh rupees that I needed. But before that, they let me go to market for 6 months and write hundreds of grant applications, nothing. So the money didn't come easy. They could have very easily done this long back. They wanted me to go through that process. And then the thought process was build something, show some progress. Keep doing this recurringly. If you build enough momentum, somebody will fund it if it's real, right? So I've made maybe at least 90 funding decks, all none of which were funded. Then maybe 90 to 100, one of them got us the capital that we did. I think fast forward to build, going from outdoor air purifiers to industrial and then home. Look, air purification is complex because you're dealing with very varied sizes, rooms, and areas. User education is quite complicated because air pollution in itself is quite complicated. There's particles, gases, greenhouse gases, reactive, all these different sizes of particles. Then you have wind dynamics, temperature, and humidity that affects it. So as it's not as simple as it seems. So to build a good system which is actually now filterless, you're trying to capture things you can't see with the naked eye without a physical barrier. Right? That's the physics problem. And to do a large amount of it very quickly so that the impact can be measured. Right? You need a lot of different skill sets to do it. I was fortunate to have some of them. The others, I would ask around or pull favors or beg someone, can you please write this bit of code for me? Because I don't know this specific type of this, I don't know how to deal with this library or whatever, right? So fast forward to today, we build Mark II and Hive products. Like you said, manufacturing one prototype is one thing. Doing so recurringly with the quality and especially with Hive, which is very Apple-esque production quality, to do so in India is a monumental task. And as an early stage startup, you can't afford product recalls. All right, you'll bankrupt the company if you have to. So you have very little room for error. And I think even with supply chain, right, we faced a massive problem, for example, in February and March because of Chinese New Year. There was a lot of material dumping happening in India. So even domestic material would get mixed with Chinese material because both would have the same grade, right? So we had a whole batch of Hives, which had tremendous amount of slag in the aluminum. So as soon as you would put color on the, through the anodizing process or whatever, all the Hive bodies showed up with black lines, which looked like scratches. So imagine a batch of, 200 odd Hives having scratch lines across them. You can't ship it to customer. So how do you resolve these things?
Yeah, you mentioned Hives being made of aluminium, and I have not used Pran, but I can say for sure that the product quality, the look and the feel of it, and from the reviews that I read, it looks like a product built to world standards. And I recently heard the founder of an academy speak at a function, and he was telling the audience about how zero innovation happens in India. There are no companies that are coming up with genuine, legit, path-breaking products. Everything is a knockoff of what has happened in the US. And that see those seems to be the companies that get venture capital money. And venture capitals are also like, hey, this worked in the US, this may work in India, this can scale in India because of the population. But you went on a completely different route. You were like, this has to be a product first, research first company, and there will not be any compromise on the quality. What made you tread that path? You could have done it so much easier by, maybe getting things from China or, like you said, white labeling. And why do you want to insist on that product quality so much?
Look, I run Pran for the mission. I can definitely get far faster capital, personal money, or salary, or I could have over the last 7 years, right? Even in 2022, on LinkedIn, a recruiter reached out to me on behalf of an AI company. This is a hotshot recruiter, right? Top LinkedIn voice, all that. They found my details and wrote to me, saying that we're looking for a CEO for this company. We'll start with a compensation of 750K plus this ESOPs, right? Worth, I think, some $12 or $13 million in stock options. So these opportunities have come our way, but we're here for the mission. I think with respect, I know what you're talking about. I think his name is Gaurav
Munjal,
Munjal,
yeah.
if I said it correctly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know him personally. He's built a big company, but I think this his opinion is generally true, but also I think his circle is limited to these typical venture funded IIT type companies, right? We don't make so much noise. We're very picky about investors because of the hell we've been through with venture capital. And so I think exposure determines a founder's way of thinking. I'm fortunate that, I found myself in the right place at the right time multiple times in my life, and to have had a supportive family who said, "Go explore," right? Even when I was, 8 years old, 9 years old, to say, "Yeah, keep reading these science books, or go buy these things from downstairs to build whatever you want." It was small, 100 rupees, 200 rupees. But for a child, that freedom, creativity, dreaming is what helps, right? So I don't blame him or the status in India. I think I was blessed, and I hope more people get these opportunities to do these things. But for us, like I said, we're on a mission to make sure that clean air becomes democratized. And it's not just Pran that can do it, but we need tens of companies to compete with us, like actually compete with us and give us a tough time. Today, we're not being given a tough time, right? So I want companies to compete, give us a tough time, because that means that the customers are getting the best products that actually work, that actually solve the problem, right? We're funded by global venture capital. More than 90% of our money is from outside India. We're still an American company. We started there. Most of our money is from there. So why shouldn't we be judged at the global standard? I am not competing with Dyson or Philips or Honeywell. I'm here to solve the problem. If they did a better job earlier, I wouldn't have to exist, right? I would be equivalent to my classmates driving a fancy car in the Bay Area, making 500, 700K a year, and perhaps living a slightly less stressful life, right? It's important to try and solve this problem. Air purification and climate change is so boring as a topic. People will talk about it for 10, 15 minutes, feel bad, saying, "Yeah, we should do something about it." They'll tweet about it and then be like, "Okay, let me go get my burger from McDonald's in my Ford F-150." Right? So nothing changes. So how do you actually crack this? It means that you have to build products that are aspirational. You will show off a hive if it's in your room, right? And that was the thought process behind it. We have customers who are billionaires, multimillionaires. Keep it in their living room. Otherwise, if you see a user who has a Dyson or a Honeywell, or the typical,
Premium, yeah.
not to put down any company, but more so like talking about a typical white plastic product. They'll have it around the house, and then as soon as a guest or somebody's coming over, they'll move it to the side and store it inside. They, "I don't want this random plastic object in my living room." It's the opposite with Hive. They want to show it off and they want to talk about it. It was so unique, looks so different. It looks like an expensive Apple product kept in the living room. So if you
What
walk
is
into
that
the
little
room,
thing doing over there, right?
it's intriguing. Like, what is this, right? And why is it here? And the fact that, hey, your AQI is 2, unheard of in Delhi, right? So I think that was the thought processing. Let's build the best in the world, and then let's figure out how to make it accessible to more and more people, either with manufacturing improvement or introducing more cost-friendly alternatives over time, and so on.
Yeah, you spoke about not making a lot of noise, and I also noticed that the marketing, there is probably no marketing at all. It's just tweets from reputed people endorsing Pran, which is quite amazing. And yeah, I found that very intriguing. Is there a method to this that we just want word of mouth and the quality
I don't
speaks for
have the
itself?
money. I don't have the money to spend millions of dollars today. Sure, we're working on it, and we'll go, wilder with it, I would say. But I think it's important to have a small pool of customers who are such big endorsers. You don't need a marketing. I don't have a marketing person. Check our LinkedIn. there's nobody who works in marketing at France, right? We've spent $0 on marketing. So my only request to customers is, you know, here's the product, thanks for believing in us. And they buy it because almost everyone's bought it because of how it looks. And then when it actually works and people experience the software and the crazy reporting, they're like, I've never seen something like this, right? I remember a guy called Ritesh Malik. He's an angel investor and eventually invested in Pran as well. 7 a.m. in the morning, he got a report on a Sunday from our software. He's like, I've never seen something like this. This is brilliant in all caps, right? So when a customer is passionate about it, right, and about using your product, and he's bought one, then he's bought five, and then he's bought seven more, three-time repeat customer, I think, and it's not a cheap product, it's still like $600, $700, right? I think that's the indicator for product market fit. So as we get more and more of them, all I request them is, hey, if you like it, can you introduce me to a few more people, or can you put it on a group, or can I get five sentences from you? That is my marketing. I mean, sure, we'll spend more money in the years to come. But today, we just want to build a solid product, make sure it's really working, all the customers are happy, you know, issues are ironed out. The hive gets smarter with every additional hive we deploy. It's all on the cluster, it's all over the air updates. It's, you know, you don't even know we've made it better than we did, right? Suddenly, you'll see three new crazy features on the app. So yeah, I think that's currently the approach with at least Hive.
Yeah. We spoke about Hive and how it has delighted customers. If you could maybe explain the tech behind this to the audience, because it is not a discernible change that we see, right? So let's say the air quality index outside is 200 and it's 10. We don't see the product actually work. So maybe let's just spend some time on diving a little bit into the tech and how this filterless technology works.
So, I mean, the filterless is in our Mark II. Hive still has a filter. Hive has a whole different user experience problem that's getting solved. But Mark II, look, fundamentally, all we're doing is few electrostatic precipitators have existed for decades. They used a basic, you know, physics principle of electric field, where you emit charges and they stick to particles of opposing charge or neutral charge, you can then draw these particles in the electric field and make them stick to another surface. Right? Basic electric field theory. But to scale this down safely, to do it in a manner where you're able to pass high volumes of air at low energy level in a small form factor and have very high capture efficiency of these tiny particles is a very hard physics balancing problem. That's what took us so long, from my sophomore year of college to 2021 when we raised venture capital. It's very hard to firstly build something like this, second, the instruments to even test it, right? You can't see it, so you have to rely on sensors. The cheap sensors don't give good enough data where you can do something with it. The expensive ones you can't afford. Today, even when I can afford it, there's so much variation. I buy five identical $10,000 sensors, they give me different data. So how do you actually solve this problem? I think fundamentally the way it works is we draw in polluted air. We charge the particles, separate them, they stick to the inside of these cores, and clean air leaves out. Once the inside of these cores gets filled, it's automatically sensed. And these particles that are sticking to the inside are dumped down into a collection bucket, and the operation resumes. So every time the core gets filled, for a few seconds, the fan turns off, dumps the dust, resumes operation again. So in this manner, we are able to continuously capture an near infinite volume of particles and clean the air in the space.
Mm. And pretty seamless user experience, right? You don't have to change a filter. You don't have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, hey, this isn't running at 100% efficiency because it all does it by itself.
Yeah, it's automatically adapting. Even when the dust cells are too high, it's going to tell you the time it's going to take to get lower. You're able to see this predictably. And we now deploy this on shop floors in large factories, you know, steel, cement, elastomer, spices, you know, pharmaceutical, all the industries that deal with powders or generate powders as a function of their operations.
Yeah. You mentioned to me briefly before the start of the interview that this is just the beginning, and you have this Edith philosophy that that you want to run with, and you have a greater vision, and the current products are just sort of, you know, the beginning of a much larger vision that you are or an endeavor that you are onto. Tell me more about that.
So Pran's vision is very clear. We want to rebuild the atmosphere, right? Sounds borderline like crazy. So the way we sort of broke this vision up is, let's solve for where people are walking and breathing and the atmosphere is affecting lives and health, and that's air pollution. And then let's solve for climate, which is capture and reutilize greenhouse gases directly from the atmosphere. So we took these as two sequential problem statements. Where people are walking and breathing includes outdoors, indoors, factories, right? These are all the places where we need clean air. And if you want to solve it, you first need to be able to measure it. Second, you need to be able to simulate it. How is it actually flowing, where it's coming from, you know, wind conditions, humidity, temperature, etc. Third is, once you can simulate it, you need to be able to actually solve it. So, you know, filterless or filter-based removal and what kind of products and so on. And fourth, it needs to validate and self-improve. So that's all the software and the AI and the IoT elements. So I call it the clean air stack. So our first step was to build a clean air stack, and we did. So we built SES, which stands for Spatial and Environmental Sensing, which is our sensor product. We don't sell it, we use it for our own applications. We built the simulation platform. First, we partnered with Ansys, which is the largest simulation company in the world. They've been awesome with us.
Now Synopsys.
And, you know, fantastic partners for Pran. And, you know, they gave us software when we couldn't afford it. And then over time, you know, we've grown with it and we've improved even more than what their software can do. And then with purifiers, we built the outdoor one, Mark 1. We built Mark 2 for industrial and heavy and large spaces. We built multiple variants of Hive, and now we're shipping Hive to consumers, so all kinds of indoor spaces. And all of these products have their own software, they have their own reporting, they self-enhance their performance. So we built the clean air stack. Now in future, this clean air stack may have different products, they'll have a new Hive, a different Hive, you know, different features, but at the end of the day, you've built the stack that solves air pollution everywhere, right? And moving forward is the stage where, you know, we've been running a carbon capture project. We started in, you know, 2021. Made good progress till early 22, paused it because we said, you know, a scaling limitation, the material was toxic, so on. So we changed it. Now we resumed it. We have a faster, better approach of doing it. So perhaps, you know, by December, we'll have something meaningful to show to the world, and we'll push it out for direct air capture. So we're just building on this bigger vision of, let's rebuild the atmosphere. So let's make air cleaner and healthier. And let's remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere.
Yeah, excellent. And I have been following the climate tech space for quite a while. And there is this product called Orca from this company called Climeworks in Iceland. And they use geothermal energy for carbon capture. And one of the negatives that people say is that it requires enormous amount of energy to capture carbon. And on enterprise scale or industrial scale. And have you thought about it? Because I know this rebuilding the atmosphere is one of your larger missions, but do you want to venture into spaces that reduce emissions in the first place rather than capture? Or obviously we do both, to make world a better place. But have you thought about the enormous energy consumption that is needed to capture carbon and make it, I don't know, maybe rest in peace under the earth or however?
Yeah, so I mean, Climeworks, firstly, the space started because of them. So all of us owe them a big deal, right? I think the technology is slightly older today. When they started, it was new. There are better ways to do this today. We didn't use their method. We used something called amines. We had good capture efficiency. We had a lab scale prototype working. If we wanted, we could have sold the story and raised 10, 15, 20 million based on that. But I think money is an obligation, and it's an obligation to multiply it and return it. So if I know in my heart that I can get maybe another lab scale prototype, but I can't take it to a gigaton capacity, should write back and say no. And we did that. So we took a wait and watch approach on this, saying we have to think about it more deeply. Think about it from basic fundamentals, not be trapped by what's happening in the market. Because that's what was happening earlier with all the companies, even today, right? We said the only thing I'm willing to compromise on is energy consumption. I cannot compromise on cost. I cannot compromise on the quality and sustainability of the materials I use. And I cannot compromise on whether this scales to gigaton or not. So because energy through nuclear, through solar, wind, can be created abundantly. But if you use toxic materials, you harm aquatic life, you harm soil, you can't recover from that. So you can't get best of everything. And energy also, there's so much innovation happening that that's an easier piece to solve. Trans energy will be, exponentially lower than what Climeworks uses. So I'm saying this after doing the maths.
You seem to know your numbers, so I believe you.
No, I mean, they paved the way. But I think over the last 2 years, we've really thought about it deeply. I can hint to the fact that, we'll be using materials like limestone that are abundant, which they're also doing, but they've automated the whole process. And there's a lot of mid processes which are also automated, which can be avoided. And then we're using catalysts to speed up the capture process. And in fact, there is another company who's doing or has done something kind of similar. But I think there's still differentiation between us. It's a company called Heirloom Carbon. There's a very large Series A round, which is intriguing for the market as well, and 53 million Series A, but awesome. Again, they're at least I would say they are a magnitude away from Climeworks, and then if we can be a further magnitude away from Heirloom, I think industry will move forward. So that's currently where we are. I think first we waited for some time because I don't think you should jump in out of FOMO. I'm okay to write back to investors and say I can't figure it out. I don't think it's going to work. Here's your money, right? But to take on something against a false promise and not have an answer to how does this get to billion tons, I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, you explained it perfectly. We are not there yet, but I think technology is improving at a rapid pace, so we will get there at some point. Angad, before I end this podcast, I wanted to ask you about hiring talent. I know we touched upon this briefly during your Georgia Tech days, but now that Pran is a registered company, you might find it difficult to find talent that is already experienced, let's say 10 years of experience in the climate tech space, or probably 10 years of experience with CFD or all of that, right? So you probably hire a lot of young talent, but the problem with young talent can also be that they are using Pran as a platform, and no problems with that. Someone may be planning for a master's degree. How do you keep people motivated on the overall mission, and how do you retain talent? Because I from whatever you have spoken so far, you are not going to compromise on the kind of talent that you seek for Pran. Paying them market rates, retaining them might be a struggle. And how have you been working on that?
I think more than money, the challenge is talent density. And India has we're in India firstly because I think you should be close to your problem and close to your early customers. And we make in India, so you have to be close to your vendors. You can't sit in the Bay Area and try to manage vendors. It's not going to happen. Like a manufacturing lead, is from UP Bihar. He speaks the language with the laborers or workers in those factories and gets it done. Right? I don't see a polished guy ever being able to pull this off the way it is done. Right? It's short answer is incredibly hard, not because of capital, but because of availability of talent. And everyone has this belief that, oh, all the best engineers come from India, so there must be, a billion of them sitting. I said, not every one of the billion people in this country is an engineer. And, not everyone is looking for a job even within the engineering subset. The best ones are never looking for a job. And we have such a high volume of brain drain annually that most of the super solid engineers go to grad school and then they're in the Bay Area or in Germany. The pool we are left with, and for no fault of theirs, are people who didn't have the opportunity to go overseas. Not that if they had it, they'd all go, right? And also the fact that the companies in India, including the large ones like Microsoft or even Apple, who's now in India, the work being assigned is repetitive. It's not their core R&D. Core R&D work is still happening in the Bay Area, right? So I don't want to, for example, pay 3x the salary to get someone who will do 0.2x of the work that we want to do because they have a fancy brand associated with it. So it takes us longer to hire, but the and also I think you mentioned number of years. I don't think we measure experience in number of years. We ex measure in output in the number of years that you've had. In India, there is a habit of saying, I have 10 years work experience, and sometimes it scares me. I was like, this is all you've done in 10 years? Just like you've done the same shit for 5 years. And I was like, how are you happy with this for yourself? Forget me. Like, I'm an outsider. Why are you happy with this? Right? Because our life is finite. You should at least get different experiences, right?
Yeah, on this note, I have a story to tell you about what Rishabh Pant, the cricketer, spoke about experience. And he said that once MS Dhoni told him that, if you are in the Indian team as an 18-year-old, let's say you get to 21, like just because you are 21 does not mean that you are any less experienced. How much you learn after every match, how much you get to know what to do when is what determines experience. So sometimes we often mistake the definition of experience, and I think you summed it up perfectly. And I hope a lot of people hear this, especially recruiters, that 10 years of experience does not automatically translate to impact.
Right. And this was perhaps the old way of, like, I would say post-colonial admin job type situations. But when you're running a hard tech company, you need inventiveness. And to get inventiveness means to know your fundamentals are like extremely strongly so far so that you can innovate on them. Right? So the kind of people we hire, sure, they're younger. We pay at market or most of the times above market pay. I don't think a freshman in India would graduate with the full cash compensation of 20, 25 lakh rupees. Right? So they'll typically be between 4 to 8. They're definitely above market. And that number is not true for all. We also have the 8 and 10 lakh candidates. But someone's exceptional. I think we look at it in a manner that what function do you solve, then what years of experience you have, right?
These
I
are
have
top tier CS top tech salaries in India for a fresher. So this is
right.
brilliant. Yeah.
And I mean, we're not heavy on CS hiring. Sure, we have a full stack team. We're definitely much. We spend a lot more money and number of people on hardware, and so
No, that's what I'm
different
trying to
kind.
say, is that, for a hardware specific, product specific company to pay is commendable.
Yeah, I mean, look, no one founder built the company. People should be valued the way they are and for what actual value they bring. Now, some people think they add inflated values. And my proof case is if I can get a 15,000 rupee intern to do it, it's bad news for you, right? So that's how I vet it. I'll give you example. There was a sales guy we hired for 4 to 6 months. He had no sales to show, right? And we have very set processes. Like it's spoon-fed, a child should be able to follow it and do it, right? A sales guy who can't sell is a problem, right? If there's an issue with the product, if there's an issue with the pricing, etc., none of those factors are true. So, I told him at the end of the day, you would create a list of a senior guy. That's why, I'm not so big on older people. I look at all these factors secondary. If you just create a list and you attend shows and you bring me a bunch of cards and I have to pay you 7-8x of what I would pay a junior guy who can do this, it's not justified. So to prove this case, I hired an intern for 15,000 rupees in business development. I said, can I get the same output for 15,000 rupees? This intern's elated because he has no experience and he's getting paid for zero experience to show up and do this job, right? And I was like, why am I spending 2.5 lakh rupees a month when I can spend 15,000 rupees and get the same output, right? That's my metric to test. I think for you asked me about retaining this talent. Look, it's incredibly hard. It's not just for us. I think even in Bay Area, I think what VCs and founders have gotten used to is almost 100% attrition. So what has to work is your system. You have to have exceptional documentation. Of course, stock options, money, growth, all that is subset. More than anything, today people don't want to work, right? So Pran works because people are deeply passionate about the problem. They're not here for the money. They know they're learning insane amounts every day. They want any job in the world, they'll get it. Right? So they have that, I would say, humility at the same time, confidence that they know they are not here for the job. They are here because they get to wake up every day. They don't have to worry about money. They get to work on an incredibly hard problem with other super talented people. And they are able to see output, real world measurable output for their work within months. Right? So a product which is designed in July is going to low income school in Delhi by December. And it's impacting and changing reality for 300 low income students. But they can go to school now in winter because of your product. That's like ultimate validation for the work that you're doing. Forget the revenue, right? If you've made this real, which governments couldn't do, I don't think any number on that paper will give this kind of experience.
And this brought a grin on my face that people don't want to work these days. And I'm on this platform called teamblind.com, which is this website where people can post anonymously about their job experiences, about their job offers, and all of that. And believe it or not, the most consistent post that I see across the board is that where can I coast by working 20 hours a day for 200K a year at a medium cost of living location? I'm like, how can you set this standard for yourself, right? And so that fascinates me a lot. Like, people just want to coast. And on the other hand, there are people with, let's say, 10 or 15 years of experience, think they deserve a particular pay just because they are older, or they have been in the space for so long. But sometimes markets or companies just don't work that way. And I think you beautifully summed it up as to you know, you want to get people who have a passion or some sort of a you know, some sort of an interest to the company's mission itself, so that they are just as passionate. So, because ESOPs and all of that can only do so much, right?
And I think, you know, in line with that, this is a reality. It's not just financial, right? The world rewards value, not hard work. It's unfortunate, right? It's even for founders like us. I pitched to 1,000 VCs. I should think that I deserve the money or 50 times the money I'm asking for. It's nobody cared, right? If you're not able to add value to a team that's accelerating the team, you could have 30 years of work experience and I still can't justify paying you any money, right? So I think, you know, workforce has to evolve. I think there are jobs which would be repetitive with this kind of number of years of experience type situation will, you know, reward. Not like I personally cannot, and this is not my personal belief, but I'm just trying to evaluate it as an outsider. Like, how does a company that's trying to innovate and disrupt markets and build new things, which is what most modern companies are doing, have somebody who can't maintain that culture for themselves, right? So I think that adaptability is going to become a baseline requirement. This is not a brand thing. It's, I think, every company I look at around me, it's a baseline requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we end this podcast, I want to touch on one little aspect that I noted is Pran and your mission to give back to the community. And I think this is so different from the so-called quote-unquote legacy businessmen or corporate in India who want to maybe pass it on to their kids, or you know, who want to just keep building wealth. And I see this with this new age entrepreneurs in India, be it a Nitin Kamath, who started Rain Matter to solve the problem of climate change and health and fitness, and you worked with Ansys to bring clean air to a school in Delhi. It's a fantastic thing to see that people are not just running a business, starting a company, but also doing social good on the side. And it need not be like, oh, I have to be 10x or I have to reach 10 billion to give back. You know, both can still work in parallel, and I think that is quite remarkable. Tell me about how important social good is to you, and how much satisfaction does it give to partner with a company like Ansys to bring out this change?
Look, our company's existence is only justified if, you know, even if I just look at it purely from money perspective, are we selling more number of air purifiers and are they actually working? And if that's true, it means more number of users are breathing cleaner air, which means impact is being generated. The more we succeed, the more good is happening in the world, right? So, you know, for us, it's not mutually exclusive. Revenue generation is impact for us, right? And that's the fundamental mission of the company. Now, like even when we sell, say, software or a recurring SaaS tool, it means the user is using my air purifier, which is why they have to buy the SaaS tool, which means they're beginning to have clean air every day, right? Pran has an insanely high usage rate with Hive. It's around 84% or 85%, which means 85% of users use the product every day, which is nuts. I don't know another air purification company where customers are turning it on all day, every day, every night while sleeping. People don't use it. So I think they are seeing a measurable change in their lives, which is with their family and children. I think we post about this on Twitter. We share anecdotes of customers. I think with the Ansys, you know, it was very impulsive decision I had made to do the school project. And this year we're actually scaling from those 300 kids trying to impact 50,000 students. So we're raising a far larger chunk of money to do this in Delhi. Right. And we don't make We absolutely make no money out of it. With the school project, we actually lost some money, but it was important enough to do it, so we did it. It was a call I made at, I think, 8:30 or 9 p.m. to the then CMO Rafiq Somani. I said, I'm doing this, you have to pay for it, right? And it was less of an ask, more of an indirect request that, hey, you know, this is important. If you won't do it, I don't know who I can pick up the phone like this and call, who's so high up and close to Pran where there's benefit for them. And so he said, yeah, don't worry about the money, figure out the logistics and how to do it and come back to me with the exact amount and how soon you need it. And it wasn't that much. I think it was 13 or 14 lakh rupees, which is a very small amount. I think it's like $20,000, less than $20,000. So yeah, we did it. Now it's a bigger chunk. So we're trying to figure out how to scale it.
Awesome. Well, Angad, thank you so much for spending time with me and to, you know, go through the process of founding Pran and building it, the challenges, and also what future lies ahead for you and Pran as a company. You're very, very young. I mean, it's crazy to see such clarity of thought from someone who is so young. And I think, you know, starting early, failing early, and learning more from your failures is really important. I think you have exemplified it. I hope you build far more companies that have a social impact and for social good. So all the very best for Pran and for whatever you do next.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.